South African countries who have a number of members. And quite recently, we published a book which is called Stories of Change, Agroecology as a Climate Adaptation Approach. This is written by local people themselves, you know, people who are actually practicing agroecology, who are increasing productivity, planting diverse foods, reclaiming, you know, areas which are degraded, and experimenting with biological seeds, you know, for resilience production system, food forests, in a lot of cases, 12 cases, in the number of cases are increasing. And we have been also accumulating a lot of cases. So local community.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Million Belai. Thank you so much for joining us. General Coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, Raj Patel, Research Professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. Happy birthday, Karl Marxer. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starve to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show. I'm your host for this week, Eleanor Goldfield. In the first half, we talk with Dr. Gerald Horn about the far less than lofty ideals upon which this nation was founded. Not least of all, in order to maintain slavery in the face of abolitionist sentiment in Great Britain. Dr. Horn outlines how this was a main driver in the Revolutionary War, and that our current path towards outright fascism hinges very much in the misunderstanding of our own history. Next up, I welcome back to the show journalist and organizer Jen Dierenwater for a conversation on queerness, on modern iterations of ancient queerdom, be they indigenous or Jewish, on biphobia, on realizing who you are in a void of information and support, and more. All this coming up now on Project Censored Radio.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, and other guys of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored Radio Show. We're very glad right now to be joined by Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research addresses issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. Dr. Horn is the author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly articles and reviews. His current research includes two forthcoming books, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery, Jim Crow, and the Roots of U.S. Fascism, and Revolting Capital, Racism and Radicalism in Washington, D.C., 1918 to 1968. Dr. Horn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm happy to report that both of those books have been published.
Oh, fantastic. Well, then, folks, you can add that to the long list of books by Dr. Horn to check out. So, Dr. Horn, I know that we're recording this and obviously airing it after July 4th, but I want to turn the clock back some 250 years ago at the founding of the United States, as you put it, as an apartheid nation that you mentioned in your book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. And now we're taught in this country, but I can also say as somebody who grew up in Europe, that we're also taught that the American Revolution was a huge step forwards for egalitarian ideals. Now, anybody who does even a little bit of research will find out things like, for instance, at the founding of the nation, only 6% of the population was allowed to vote. That's white property-owning men. So that immediately demotes that pedestaled revolution. But there's more to it than that. And as you note, the Africans living in what was then the American colonies were used as threats against colonists, i.e. will arm enslaved Africans and use them against you. And so Africans overwhelmingly sided with the British in the war. Britain, where by 1774, some 10 to 15,000 slaves had gained freedom. But this freedom did not apply in the British colonies. Now, Dr. Horn, I'm wondering how much did these abolitionist threats the colonists were getting from the crown weigh in the ultimate push for that Revolutionary War?
I think it was significant. As I point out in my book, and as has been validated by other researchers and scholars, in order to understand 1776, you have to understand 1772, that is to say, Somerset's case, where the settlers led by George Washington had reason to believe that England was moving to abolish slavery in England itself, and that was thought to hold jeopardy for major fortunes based upon enslaved Africans in the colonies. But it's not only that question. Keep in mind as well that 1762, 1763, you have the so-called Royal Proclamation, whereby London casts doubt upon continuing to expend blood and treasure, waging war against the indigenous nations, in order that real estate speculators like George Washington could profit. And that too was outrageous to many of the settlers, and as validated by subsequent events, we know that after the triumph of the so-called Patriots, they precisely began to steamroller through the rest of the continent, which helps to explain during round two of the battle for North America, why Tecumseh, the great Native American leader who was seeking to organize a so-called Pan-Indian Confederation, fought shoulder to shoulder with the Redcoats against the settlers. That's why in August 1814, when the Redcoats invaded Washington, D.C., and torched it, they were joined by a countless number of Black people who, of course, were laboring under enslavement, and then fled on British boats to Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continued to reside. Now, I think that many of our friends on the left, they would like to see all of us on the same page, and therefore they tend to gloss over the fact, which you introduced in your opening remarks, that obviously all of us were not on the same page. But I understand the sentiment. And what is more difficult to understand is why the formation of the United States could be seen as a great leap forward for numerous Europeans. After all, you had religious dissidents, Catholics, and those who were Jewish in the first instance, who were persecuted on the shores of Europe. But once they crossed the Atlantic, they were redefined in this identity politics of whiteness, and then did not face as much persecution on these shores as they did in Europe. Although, to be fair, they did not escape persecution altogether. There were torching of convents in the United States post-1776, reflecting what one historian called the Protestant Crusade. And of course, many Jewish people continued to be persecuted on these shores, despite the promise of the First Amendment. And so it's well past time for a reevaluation of 1776. I say this in particular, since we're facing the prospect of what many analysts consider to be an onslaught of fascism or neo-fascism. And the history that we're taught today, it seems to me, was very helpful in helping to undergird the movement against Jim Crow in the 1960s. But that was more than 50 or 60 years ago. And we all know that history changes. That helps to explain why W.E.B. Du Bois, the founder of the NAACP, the great Pan-Africanist, helped to change our perception of Reconstruction in the United States, the post-U.S. Civil War period, which to the point that W.E.B. Du Bois published his book, Black Reconstruction, was portrayed as an era of Negro corruption and cupidity. But after his book, it was portrayed as an era of democratic promise. And that is the prevailing interpretation today. And so we need a new interpretation of the founding of the United States that helps to shed light once again on why we may be on the verge of a unique and peculiar form of fascism.
I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned briefly, because I think that's also part of the problem with how we learn history. It's very much siloed. The enslaved Africans were here and the indigenous were here. But you made the point there was a lot of crossover there. And as folks have written in a variety of books, like the Indigenous People's History of the United States, for instance, runaway slaves would sometimes find their way and be welcomed into indigenous communities. How much do you feel that that solidarity and that potential was also a threat to the settlers around that time of the Revolutionary War?
Well, that is one of the more unspoken chapters in the history of the United States, although I would salute your reference to the Indigenous People's History of the United States, because it's one of the few texts that actually addresses that issue. In the book I mentioned at the top of our discussion, my book on Texas, I talk about the relationship between the Caddo people, C-A-D-D-O, on the Texas-Louisiana border, who basically had an interlocking directory with Black people. One of the major threats to U.S. seizure of Florida approximately 200 years ago was the fact that the people we refer to as the Seminoles, who, by the way, rather disgustingly, that is the nickname used by the athletic teams of Florida State University in Tallahassee, another story for another day. But in any case, the Seminoles likewise had an interlocking directorate with Black people. In fact, there were those on the scene in the 18 teens who suggested that actually the Seminoles were a Black-led indigenous formation. And certainly they wanted nothing to do with the United States of America, because the United States of America had a well-merited reputation of exacting a genocide against the indigenous and enslaving Africans wherever they could be found. What I find interesting about Native American history in retrospect is that those who sought to accommodate the settlers, I'm speaking of the Cherokee, who once occupied in profusion the southeast quadrant of North America, many of them converted to Christianity, many of them became sedentary agriculturalists, many of them actually enslaved Africans in order to accommodate themselves to the settlers. Many of them occupied mansions, but they had to go. Oftentimes, their mansions were then occupied by Europeans fresh off the boat, which, by the way, helps us to understand why it's been so difficult to revise the interpretation, the traditional interpretation of the United States, because many Europeans did benefit and profit from crossing the Atlantic. So those indigenous who accommodated themselves to the settlers oftentimes got it in the neck. And then those indigenous who fought, I'm speaking of the Comanches in the first place, some of the most fierce fighters in North America, the lords of the plains, particularly in the Texas-Oklahoma region, they too were subjected to genocide. So it was very difficult, to put it mildly, for Native Americans to survive in the face of this settler onslaught, and perhaps to make an excuse for many of the histories that have been written since. Perhaps one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to grapple with Native American history It's because so many of them have been disappeared. And so therefore, it becomes easier to ignore their previous existence. Obviously, the presence of enslaved Africans, such as my ancestors, makes it difficult to ignore our history, our presence, because you have to be able to understand why so many Black people are walking through the streets of North America. How did we get here? How did we survive? And those questions, I'm happy to say, have captivated a newer generation of historians.
You're listening to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll now continue our conversation with author and professor Dr. Gerald Horn. I am curious because you've mentioned in a couple of different contexts religion and, you know, the United States then being a place to escape to in terms of religion. I'm also curious with that, the question of slavery. It seems like some of the cases that were happening in Britain where they were asking, oh, well, should this be allowed, were because these former slaves had then been baptized. And so, oh, well, we have to recognize their freedom now. Also in the United States, I know that the role of religion was also used to keep them enslaved because the Bible has slavery in it. But was there this question of like, well, if they're baptized, then was there a role for religion there as well?
Religion is one of the most important factors in seeking to explain the history of the United States of America. Religion is an important factor in terms of the fundamental question of why it is in this hemisphere the Protestants prevailed in what is now the United States of America, stretching north into Canada. But south of the United States, you see countless numbers of Spanish speakers, of Spanish, Portuguese, and French ancestry. And in order to understand that, you may want to consult my book on the 16th century, because what basically happens is that the rise of Martin Luther, 1517, and the Protestant secession from the Catholic Church happens simultaneous with the European invasion of the Americas. Protestantism, as we well know, then sweeps through England in the 1530s. It helps to generate countless conflict between English Protestants and Irish Catholics and Scottish Catholics. At the same time, England is trying to emulate the Iberian powers, Spain and Portugal, in setting up settlements in North America. Now, Spain in particular had a religious qualification for settlement. That is to say, officially, in order to settle Spanish Florida, which they occupied in 1565, you had to be Catholic. London, the Protestant power, the scrappy underdog, moved in a different direction. That is to say that it did not mandate a religious qualification for settlement. If you look at the history of Maryland and Baltimore, for example, they're English Catholics, Lord Baltimore, who settled that particular region beginning in the first few decades of the 17th century. And so what you see is that that leads to a certain kind of reconciliation between English Protestants and Irish Catholics and Scottish Catholics as they join hands in a new identity politics of whiteness, which then morphs into white supremacy and ultimately allows those who have been warring on the shores of Europe, not only English versus Irish and English versus Scots, but British versus German and German versus Pole and Pole versus Russian and Northern Italian versus Southern Italian and Serb versus Croat. All of a sudden, when they cross the Atlantic, they adopt this new identity of whiteness, which morphs into white supremacy, which is something that is still, I'm afraid to say, endemic on these shores. And that also helps to explain why the Protestants in the first instance were able to prevail in North America, or at least in what is now the United States and Canada, but not necessarily south of the U.S. Border. Now, with regard to the enslaved, it was something of a false promise to the enslaved. That is to say, initially the idea was these Africans were being enslaved because they were pagans, so-called, because they were non-Christians. And so one would think that after they were converted or did convert, that somehow that would be an escape hatch, allowing him to escape enslavement. But no, 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 it was a false promise. And so you still see that a disproportionate number of Black people in the United States are Protestants. But because of the inadequate teaching of history in this country, many of them oftentimes are unaware of why they are Protestants, given the fact that Governor DeSantis of Florida is making a big to-do about what he calls woke history, which translated means accurate history. It's doubtful if many of these Black people, or any people for that matter, will be enlightened. He's been one up by Mr. Trump, who in the waning days of his administration appointed a so-called 1776 commission to make sure that more accurate and adequate interpretations of the history of this country would not emerge. And of course, the United States is facing its 250th anniversary in 2026, and already there are signs and glimmerings that this will not be an occasion for the emergence of a more accurate history, particularly, once again, if you look at Virginia, where Governor Youngkin, a former titan of Wall Street, is able to become elected governor of the Cavalier State, speaking of Virginia, on the premise that he's campaigning against so-called critical race theory, he's campaigning against so-called woke history, any kind of history that makes little Johnny and little Jennifer supposedly feel bad about themselves. That includes reading the novels of Toni Morrison, the late Nobel laureate. So I think your audience should understand that history is about an accurate and adequate interpretation of the past, but as my invoking of these elected officials and politicians tends to suggest, it's also about the present and also about shaping what kind of future we're going to enjoy.
I'm reminded of the James Baldwin quote, although I might be butchering it, the history is not past. And you talking about current politics made me think of this, that, you know, in the U.S., we're very much stuck in a binary, like, oh, well, if you're not for the Democrat, you must be for the Republican. And so I'm wondering, in this diving into U.S. history and this deconstructing it, is there a worry that students might see Great Britain as a really benevolent power? Like, oh, well, the Revolutionary War was bad, but see, Britain was trying to abolish slavery and they didn't want to get into the indigenous lands in the West, so they're the good guys. Do you find people trying to latch on to that as an alternative to the Revolutionary War as a positive?
Well, I think what you're pointing up is that history is complicated. It's not a simple tale of good guys and bad guys. If you look at World War II, the United States was allied with the Soviet Union. That's the way it was able to prevail against Nazi Germany. I pointed out in a previous book that it was President Roosevelt himself that encouraged Warner Brothers to produce the movie Mission to Moscow, which you can find online, which portrays Mr. Stalin, now viewed widely in the United States as a tin pot dictator, as a benevolent leader, much beloved by his people. And so the United States is not necessarily innocent when it comes to revising interpretations. And with regard to Britain, the fact of the matter is that just like the United States owes a debt of gratitude to the Soviet Union for helping to defeat Nazi Germany, the fact of the matter is that Britain was more advanced than the United States on the question of enslavement, which is not to say that it was a progressive nation, which is not to say that it was the savior of humanity. It is to say, speaking factually, that Britain abolished the slave trade before the United States in 1807. The British abolished slavery in Jamaica, Barbados, etc. in the 1830s. The United States had to wait for a civil war, a bloody civil war, in order to reluctantly abolish slavery. Those are just the facts. Now, I know U.S. patriots, they tried to twist that, make it seem as if you're an apologist for London. It reminds me of what the comedian Stephen Colbert once said, that reality has a progressive bias. When you try to paint a realistic picture, it inevitably, I would hope, leads you towards a progressive interpretation. But I think it's time for the U.S. patriots to wake up and realize that the United States was not necessarily seen by Black people in particular as some sort of savior, although that's what we're supposed to believe in school. And once again, turn to Canada, for example. Now, when I juxtapose Canada and the United States, I open myself up for attacks from the left with regard to Canada's maltreatment of the indigenous. But the fact of the matter is that Canada is a control group, as the social scientists might say. It did not rebel against London's rule. And yet, Toronto just elected a socialist mayor a few days ago. Canada has the single-payer healthcare system for medical care that we can only dream about in this country. And folks should draw some inferences from that juxtaposition. And as long as you style yourself as some sort of a blind, unseeing patriot devoted to the United States, defending it from the right, defending it from the left, I don't think that we'll be able to dig ourselves out of the deep hole in which we find ourselves, which once again has us barreling down the track towards the neo-fascism.
And I don't honestly know how you can defend the U.S. from the left. And kind of like wrapping up here, I'm curious, this is, I suppose, a bit more of a philosophical question, but and even just particularly recently, as we saw with the affirmative action case and having read Justice Jackson's dissenting opinion, she did what I felt was a pretty good job of condensing some of the history of affirmative action, as she puts it, in maintaining the role of white people and white supremacy, quite clearly. And so the question is, if the foundation of the country in this case is rotten, an apartheid state based on slavery and genocide, and the history leading up to the present has failed to rectify that original horror, do you see a future for racial equality in the United States?
My simple answer is yes, but obviously I can be accused, perhaps understandably, of being a naive for saying that in light of my previous remarks about barreling down the tracks towards neo-fascism. I could be accused of, as the lawyers say, pleading inconsistent counts. That is to say, Your Honor, my client didn't do it and he won't do it again. But as a person who studied history, as a person who's written about the 16th century, the 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th century, I don't have a Whiggish view of constant progress, but I have seen the erosion of the slave trade, the erosion of slavery, the erosion of U.S. apartheid. And I think that part of getting us to the goal line of the kind of equality that's implicated in your question is rethinking how we got to this point, and particularly stressing international alliances. That's the way historically we've been able to circumvent and do an end run around this right-wing hegemony that obtains amongst too many in this country. And so I guess I would revise my remarks to say, yes, I do think the kind of equality that you suggest is possible, but it will involve a rejiggering, a recalibration, a recalculation of the kinds of strategies and tactics we pursue to this point. Now, with regard to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's dissenting opinion in the affirmative action case, I recommend that your audience peruse that opinion, because she zeroes in not only on what you mentioned, which is that United States history up to this point has been a massive program of affirmative action for the settlers. They were the ones who benefited from, in the first instance, from seizing the land of the indigenous a population, particularly after the passage of the so-called Homestead Act in the 1860s. The Columbia University political scientist Ira Katznelson wrote a book called When Affirmative Action Was White, for example. And then under immense pressure, both globally and domestically, you have these halting and tentative steps toward a new kind of affirmative action, which the Supreme Court has wounded severely. However, as Justice Brown Jackson pointed out in her opinion, there's a footnote in Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion that has a carve out to continue affirmative action for military academies, for West Point, for the U.S. Naval Academy, for the U.S. Air Force, Academy in Colorado Springs, presumably for the Citadel in South Carolina, Virginia Military Institute in Lexington, Virginia. In light of the fact that as we speak, the leading uniformed and civilian leaders of the U.S. military are both of African ancestry, speaking of Lloyd Austin, Pentagon Chief, Sekou Brown, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So as Justice Brown Jackson said, the United States, per this opinion, is saying that it's okay to integrate Black people and other people of color into the bunker, but not the boardroom. I would say it's suggesting that we can still be conscripted to defend the empire, as we have been forced to do in all of these countless wars over the decades, of Vietnam, not least, where for the longest period of time, Black mortality rates were much higher than non-Black mortality rates. And that's sending a very disturbing signal, to put it mildly. And I should also say that understandably, there's this focus on Black people when it comes to affirmative action. But as a number of studies have shown, perhaps the leading recipient of this positive discrimination, to use the term from London, would be women of European descent. And then the question becomes, is that on the chopping block as well? Will programs, as they sought to have in California, to have corporations that do business in California, have a complement of women on the board? Is that now on the chopping block, for example? Attempts to recruit women into STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, is that on the chopping block right now? I think that a Pandora's box has been opened, and understandably now the progressive movement is going after legacy admissions, which is a lingering aspect of affirmative action for wealthy white families. This is the program whereby if your grandparents and parents attended Harvard, you get affirmative action points, for example, that boost you over those whose parents and grandparents did not attend Harvard. That is still intact. It'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does, if and when that comes before them. But I think that the message should be clear, particularly to communities of color, particularly to Black people, that if you look at our history, one of the ways we've been able to advance is not only through domestic alliances, it's been through international alliances. That's the import of the Haitian Revolution and its impact on slavery, the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which has enormous impact on these shores. That's the impact of the coming to independence of African and Caribbean nations simultaneously and not coincidentally with the rise of the civil rights movement, because they were joined and interlocked. And that's the lesson that's precisely been lost in 2023, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we've been enduring and suffering so many setbacks.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We'll be right back after this quick musical break, so please stay with us.
We stand up tall against the other side. We are the nation of tomorrow. We are the children who are not afraid to die. Say yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, the Project Censored radio show. This segment is a bit different than the typical interview setup. Today, we're going to be talking about queer journeys, and not least of all, the bi and or pansexual journey is one of the ones that is often censored and shown as confused, reckless, slutty, etc. And since this is Project Censored, in the interest of bringing forward the lived experiences that are not in the Lockheed Martin-funded pride parades and news coverage, I'm very glad to be joined once again on the show by my dear friend and partner in Binus,
Jen Dierenwater, who is a bisexual, two-spirit, multiply disabled citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, and an award-winning journalist and organizer who covers the myriad of issues her communities face with an intersectional lens. Jen is the founding executive director of Crushing Colonialism and a 2019 New Economies Reporting Project and 2020 Disabilities Futures Fellow. Jen is a regular contributor to Truth Out, and her work has been featured in a wide range of publications as well as anthologies. The Advocate named Jen a 2019 Champion of Pride. Jen is also a 2022 member of the Susan M. Daniels Disability Mentoring Hall of Fame. And while raised in rural areas of her nation's reservation, Oklahoma, and in rural Texas, and a nomad at heart, Jen currently lives on occupied Piscataway land known as Washington, D.C. Jen, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
So I thought about when we were at Baltimore Pride together, and I thought, you know, this is really something that should be discussed because it is very censored, this bi in particular, this bi journey. I wanted to start off just asking and talking about that initial time. I don't want to say moment because that's too much like, oh, that was July 2nd, where you started to have questions about this heteronormative structure that you were brought up in.
That's a question. I would say when I was a child, honestly, is when I started questioning it. Long before I ever knew, had even the slightest inkling that I could be queer, you know, I saw a lot of, not all of my family, but I saw some very gendered roles around who does what in the household. You know, I come from a family where the women had to work outside of the home. It wasn't financially possible for women to just be, quote, stay at home moms and wives. But at the end of the day, when they'd come home, they were still expected to cook and clean and do all the childcare. So there were a lot of things I saw growing up that I didn't understand. And it didn't make sense to me. I was like, why would I want to take part in this? From what I'm seeing, the women in my family are run ragged while the men just have one job. You know, so there were just a lot of things there that I already was just like, no, thanks. I don't want any part of this. Like, I decided when I was quite young that I didn't want to get married and I didn't want to have children. And I'm 44 and I'm still very thankful every second of every day that I am single and child free.
And when you were growing up, was the concept of bisexuality or was the concept of two-spirit something that you were introduced to?
No, not at all. Kind of like in our conversation at Pride recently, you know, I did not knowingly, like I didn't know an open queer person until I was 21 when I had left home and was living in Los Angeles. There was no recognition whatsoever of queerness outside of just the Christians that I grew up around saying how horrible queer people were. So, you know, I thought the feelings that I had for women when I was younger, honestly, I thought they were just because men were such sexist and abusive people. Wasn't until I got older and realized, oh, no, wait, I'm bi. I just intensely dislike men as human beings, but I'm actually attracted to all the genders. So, yeah, that's what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because my mom's an artist and I remember I would look through her art books very often. And there are, of course, a lot of nude women in art books. And I just thought that because my mom would point out, oh, art, isn't this beautiful art? I was like, oh, so every woman thinks that other naked women are really beautiful and also attractive in that kind of way. And that's just a thing. And so I guess that makes me straight, right? And it wasn't until I was older that I was like, oh, you guys don't feel the same way? Oh, that's weird. Like, and I was also, I grew up in North Carolina, which is also very, very, very narrow. And the school that I went to, people threw food at me in the cafeteria just for saying no to the Iraq War. So the idea of being queer was absolutely not up for discussion. And I just remember trying to really be very outwardly straight. And I'm not even sure like how you can do that, but I tried to be like very, no, I'm definitely straight because I played softball and everybody thought that the theater kids were gay. So I had like two strikes against me. And people would call me dyke. And I was like, no, I'm straight. I just also think that women are attractive. is this weird? Is this is normal, right? But like, I had nobody to talk to about it because nobody else was openly queer. And then of course, later on Facebook, a bunch of people that I went to school with are now openly queer, but we were all just kind of like, no, we're straight. We're super, super straight. Okay. Please, please don't throw food at me or beat me up after school. There was nowhere to discuss these thoughts and these feelings. And I imagine had there been any professors or any teachers, that they would have been fired if they even entertained the conversation with a student asking them like if these feelings were normal.
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine having asked anyone that I went to school with, student or faculty, for help. I mean, I struggled a great deal with suicidal ideation. I tried to kill myself several times as a kid. Like, I already wasn't getting help and support as like a Native child and one who was chronically ill and suicidal. I can't imagine if I had realized I was queer as well. Like, I almost think that my subconscious maybe subverted it to keep me alive. I kind of wonder sometimes, as well as just, you know, not having anyone to talk to and not having anyone to look to, you know, even coming out as bi, it was later in life, it was really difficult for me because there was still very much this attitude that I would sometimes get from people of, oh, well, you're just confused. You don't understand. You're really just straight. I'd get that a lot because I'm more feminine in my appearance. Or I would sometimes get, well, you're just really gay and you don't know it yet. Or, and I've gotten this one, including from a therapist, that I'm just bi because I'm a rape survivor. Because, you know, that's how sexuality works. So even as an adult, there's still, like, even now that I know who I am and I'm confident in that, there's still that nonsense. There's still people to this day acting like bisexuality isn't real or they don't want to date me because of it. I remember all the jokes as well when I came out of, oh, you're bi, all your options have increased. And I'm like, actually, they decreased. I don't have extra options. Just call me a bitter bisexual. I hate everybody.
Dude, it's so true that, well, the trope is like, oh, you're bi, so you're slutty. First of all, there's nothing wrong with enjoying sex. That's the first point. But secondly, no, I am like the most picky person that I know. So I've probably had sex with way less people than my straight and just gay friends have because I'm so picky. Like, bi does not mean that you are just like, yeah, I'll have sex with anything. But this also was like a common trope with gay folks and back in the day. Like, what's next? Having sex with donkeys? And the mental health issue is something that we see a lot with particularly trans kids. Like, oh, it's because you were abused as a child, or it's because you have mental health issues, that's why you're trans, as opposed to this is really who that person is. I guess it's not okay, but it's more predictable in the straight male community for the, you know, when I've dated guys, they've been like, well, you're with me, so you must just be straight. But in the queer community, there were a lot of women that would say, well, you're with me, so you're just a lesbian, why can't you just accept it? Really just trying to blot out the B and LGBT. Like, that's not a thing. Like, why are we infighting? Enough people hate us anyway. Like, why are we hating each other?
Yeah. I really kind of pulled away from queer community years ago because of the biphobia and then just the anti-Native racism. And now as a disabled person, I can't even go to most queer bars or events because no one bothers to make anything disability accessible. So I, in general, am just like, I feel like I'm just a queer out here on an island by my own.
Well, and I wanted to dig into some of those intersections as well. In terms of being Two-Spirit, was that a journey that happened in parallel, or was that something that came about because you did your own research after you had already embraced being bi?
All of the natives that I grew up around were pretty anti-queer. They either said things that were outright anti-queer, or they just made it very well known that queerness was uncomfortable and unacceptable. You had to behave in a certain way, or you weren't a real man, you weren't a real woman. I now recognize that that thought process is not in line with the traditional values of my tribe. It's not in line with many nations, but that is how some of our relatives are now as a result of colonialism. But the first time I heard the word two-spirit was when I was in college. I was an undergrad at USC and many thoughts on that school. I will save them. But there was a professor who was a wretched human being, Walter Williams, was later arrested for pedophilia. Lovely, lovely human being. And he's still considered to this day one of the lead researchers on two-spirit people. Horribly misogynistic, an abuser, and completely racist, and had no understanding of what two-spirit actually is. So everything I learned about two-spirits originally came from this really atrocious white man, this really awful white man who's done awful things to our communities and have stolen so much from us. And so all of my concepts of indigeneity and queerness up until my 30s, like that was kind of all I had, was either we hate queer people or it's this one narrow interpretation by this racist, abusive white man. And then I started meeting more openly queer people. It was actually a lot of friends in Canada who were the ones who really started explaining to me like what gender looked like amongst different nations, where the term two-spirit came from, how it was applicable to me. It was a long journey of learning that I was two-spirit and realizing that versus being bi. That just kind of came to me within a couple of months. It was like, oh, hey, I'm bi. But two-spirit was a longer journey. But that's also because being two-spirit, it's not just like a gender identity. It's a role within tribal community. It's a role within indigenous community. It's not the same as I just check a box. Like this comes with roles and duties within my people that I am obliged to do. So I did not publicly come out as two-spirit until I was, I don't know, somewhere in my late 30s.
I think that also says a lot about traditional communities, indigenous communities versus colonialist communities, because checking a box, it's like, okay, I just check a box and I don't have any accountability to any community or any people. I'm just me, my individualist self. It's all about me and how I see myself. But to actually embrace a term, it was somebody at a pipeline protest that was explaining to me that, you know, you can't just call someone auntie in the indigenous community. Like that is a role. Whereas in the colonialist perspective, it's like, oh, that's just an aunt. That's just a thing that happened because your sibling had sex with someone else and had a kid. Like that's just, it's a very passive thing. And I wish that the queer community had more of a sense of that responsibility to each other, which is really the grassroots of pride anyway. You know, these riots that demanded justice and human rights. But with regards to those intersections too, I'm curious because in my history, being both Nordic and Jewish, I feel like most of the Nordic has gotten lost because I do feel at some point in everybody's history, there was an embrace of these queer identities, but it's been lost with the colonialism that happened in these nation states as they formed, you know, when Sweden became a nation state. And by that, you have to dictate who belongs and who doesn't belong. You can see that along the indigenous lines, but also means along like gendered lines. So what was lost? And I know that a lot of people will point to like, oh, well, in Viking mythology, Thor dresses up as a woman and da, da, da. But that wasn't considered a good thing. Viking society was very, very gendered. And that didn't mean that women didn't have power. Women had a lot of power as seers and inside the home and on farms and things, but it was very, very gendered. And when it came to government, women were not part of it. And if they were, it was, you know, the exception. So this trying to twist Viking mythology for a leftist perspective can be romantic, but there's absolutely nothing historically to show for that. And I am saddened to think of everything before that, you know, in the hundreds and hundreds of years before when that part of the world was settled, what was lost, like what kind of ideas about gender and what kind of acceptance and embracing of different identities was lost because of these more militant and gendered perspectives.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host this week, Eleanor Goldfield. We now continue our conversation with organizer and journalist Jen Dierenwater.
you know, as I've gotten older, I realize, well, all of this is just so muddied. I mean, even just me to this day grappling with bi and pan, it's all just very fluid. Gender is fluid and my preferences are fluid. And I'm curious, do you have that same feeling? Is pansexuality something that you use, or are there other terms that you would use to describe yourself?
I think probably pansexual is more in line with who and what I am, especially as like my own ideas of gender have expanded over the years. You know, I still just say that I'm bi because biphobia is real. It's a thing. Even though some folks like to act like it doesn't exist, it does. It's real. It's still around. I don't know. I feel like for me, it's more the individual than the gender. It's more the connection I have with someone. You and I are both very sapiosexual. We've had those conversations. And unlike you, though, when I was younger, I was a lot less selective in my partners. But as the years went on, I realized more and more, if I just don't have an intellectual connection with someone, I just don't have the level of attraction and the interest. And now at 44, I'm just kind of like, you know, I've already been out there. I've already done everyone. It's about the individual. And if you're not right for me, then I'd just rather be at home with my cats, reading a book, or watching TV. That's where I'm at.
Is there, in terms of the comparison between how we talk about it in a, you know, an English-speaking colonialist perspective, bi, pansexual, are there similar conversations in the indigenous community and similar research trying to dig up what's been, I don't want to use the word lost because it makes it sound like y'all just dropped it when you were on a walk or something, that's been destroyed? I hate when people are like, oh, the Palestinian people lost land. I'm like, dude, it wasn't lost. No, I lost my keys. That was stolen violently. Is there any, you know, kind of research into what was stolen and what was destroyed by colonialisms in terms of these identities?
Yeah, there's a growing amount of research being done. Some are academics, some are other types of storytellers who are sort of bringing back some of that knowledge about, you know, different gender identities and different ways of seeing sexuality and gender within traditional indigenous ways. It's tough, though, because as people who are more oral storytellers, we don't have written documents to look to. So when your people are all being murdered and there are no documents, not that documents can't be destroyed and aren't all the time in acts of war, but it makes it harder. It makes it harder to know that knowledge that was lost. And the knowledge of our, you know, multigendered people was purposefully oppressed. You know, there are some records of the Spanish, for example, taking people that they did not consider to be, you know, the right kind of men and doing awful things to them. There are records of Bureau of Indian Affairs officers requiring that men and women dress a certain way on the reservations they were forced onto. So there's some documentation out there about the suppression of our ways, but it is kind of hard. I've done a little bit of research, but a lot of it just comes down to family history, you know, stories shared amongst communities and elders. And so then it really takes the time and the knowledge of finding the right people. And it's pretty resource intensive to do that kind of research.
I imagine it is. And I was thinking while you were talking about the modern iterations of something that we know existed. For instance, in Judaism, there's like the queer mikveh project. Mikveh is a ritual bath. And it's today very gendered. So like the women and the men are separated and they cannot do mikveh together. But if you don't identify in that binary, then you are barred from partaking. So there's the queer mikveh project that allows folks who identify as any gender to partake. There's the Anarcho-Fagala Collective, which I love. Fagala is the Yiddish word for queer. Outlive them in New York City. And a lot of what they're doing is creating a new iteration of what we know as Jews existed, and a lot of times had to exist quietly, which is kind of ridiculous because Jews had to exist so quietly for so long anyway. It's like, could I just at least be myself as a Jew? But this is also part of that emulating the oppressor, which is, of course, what we see on a grand scale in the creation of Israel as a state. And I also was thinking about Braiding Sweetgrass, which is a phenomenally beautiful book. But in one of the chapters, she talks about how her father used to do a prayer when they were out camping. And I'm paraphrasing here, but she was saying that her father didn't know if this was actually the prayer that his ancestors used to start the day. But he said that wasn't the point because the earth still understood him, and the earth understood his intent and his intention with that basically new prayer. Do you feel like there's something similar happening in indigenous communities where, okay, well, that was destroyed. So how can we, as the future of our ancestors, create something today that might not be exactly what existed, but it's the same feeling and it's the same vibe, and our ancestors will see and respect that?
Yeah. You know, I see it in a, I see that in a lot of different spaces. You know, the one that just most immediately comes to mind is the Two-Spirit camp out at Ochedi Shikoi when the No-Dapple camps were up resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. There were some people out there who did not welcome the Two-Spirits. They didn't want us there. They didn't see us as leaders and warriors. But people like Candy Bringsplenty, for example, just kept at it and said, no, this is our place and we're here and we're going to fight for what's right. So you do see that, that there are spaces in which I see these things, sorts of things happening. There are some ceremonial spaces where they say, you know what, we're not going to make women go over here, men go over there. We're going to let you go in whichever ceremonial space feels right for you. But it's a lot of it comes down to more community. Are there any large nonprofits or projects or things like that? No, but also let's be real. I think it's only like 0.2% of philanthropic dollars. Like, it's significantly less than even 1% of philanthropic dollars goes to Native causes. And then amongst those, very little of that goes to queer natives. So we don't have those sorts of like formal structures and things in place a lot of times for a host of reasons. But people are out here doing things. They're trying to decolonize. They're trying to take back things and make it more accessible to people, even very, very slowly, way too slowly, in my opinion. But I am starting to see like the beginning kindling of like recognizing disability access. It's way too slow going, but you know, there are some people up in Toronto who just made a power chair friendly sweat lodge. There are some people in Baltimore who were talking to me about how can we make us rebuild our sweat lodge to make it more accessible. So there are a lot of ways I see in community, in Native community, where people are, they are working, they are trying to make it more open to all of our relatives, but we didn't get like this overnight, and we're certainly not going to unlearn over 500 years of colonialism overnight, and especially not when we are so purposefully under-resourced by foundations and governments.
Well, I feel like we could have this conversation for the next 4 hours, but I definitely recommend that folks check out Jen's work.
So jdeerandwater.com is my website, or crushingcolonialism.org. You can find Jen Deerandwater and Crushing Colonialism on all of the social media platforms.
We want to smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S., from Maui to New York, and you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed. And be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, uplift our brothers and our sisters. The mission, we wanna crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We got the love, uplift our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is conducting a survey. Help us shape the types of news, public affairs, and music programming KBOO broadcasts in the future. Tell us how you listen to KBOO, and we'll use this feedback to help serve you better. The survey is anonymous. However, you will have an opportunity to provide your contact information to enter a drawing. 10 lucky winners will receive a $50 gift card. Complete the community survey before Sunday, July 16th. Go to our website at kboo.fm/survey23. That's kboo.fm/survey23. Thank you in advance for your time and your feedback. Stay tuned for KBOO's next strategic plan coming soon.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page.